The parsha of Chukas begins with Paraduma, of course, the famous Chukas HaTorah. And there's an equally famous comment of Rashi on the words Chukas HaTorah. Rashi says, Zos Chukas HaTorah, says the pasuk in introduction of the Paraduma. It says, Rashi, what's it all about? Lefisha Satan v'umos ha'olam, because the Satan, the nations of the world, monim es Yisrael, they oppress or antagonize the Jewish people, lomar, about these mitzvahs. Ma mitzvah zos, what is this mitzvah? Ma tam yishba, what's its reason? That's what they say. Therefore, lefichach, kosa ba chuka. So to that end, the Torah writes the word chuka. Gezeirei milafonai, meaning it's a decree, says Hashem, from before me. Ein lecha reshus laharher achareha. You do not have a permission or license to try and second guess it or to overthink it and to try and fathom its reason. So say the comment of Rashi is well known, because as we know, and Rashi in fact has told us already on a number of occasions that this is the particular connotation of the word chukah. There's many words for mitzvahs. There's mishpatim and pikudim and chukim and mitzvos. And the specific flavor of the word chukah is a mitzvah whose reason we do not understand. What's very interesting to ponder about this Rashi is here, the Rashi is a little different than on previous occasions. We've had Rashi in Parshas Toldos, in Parshas Acharemos, in another one or two places. When the word chukah appears, Rashi tells you what a chukah is. But if we're particular here, Rashi in this comment didn't really tell us what a chukah is. I mean, it came out from his words. But his goal is not so much to tell us what a chukah means, but rather to explain why the Torah writes it. As if to say, probably the easiest way to ask this question is, what's the cause and what's the effect? These reactions of the nations of the world to antagonize the Jewish people, what's this mitzvah, what's it all about? Is that the cause of what the pasuk says, or the effect of what the pasuk says? I believe that we normally understand that it's the effect, as if to say, you have this mitzvah, we don't understand it, and that has the effect of people reacting badly to it and trying to give us a hard time about it. So their response is the effect of the existence of the chok. Rashi actually says the opposite. Rashi says, in response to their response, as if to say, he starts with them, seeing as the nations of the world, they say, what's this mitzvah all about? Therefore, lefichach, to that end, the Torah wrote Zos Chukas HaTorah, which means there are really two questions here, and they're not exactly the same, related though they may be. Number one, what are we to make of Parah Aduma? The answer is, we don't know. Number two, what does the Torah mean by stating and emphasizing Zos Chukas HaTorah? It's a separate question. If we don't understand the Parah Aduma, we don't necessarily need the Torah to tell us that we don't understand. It's enough for us just to have the mitzvah and not understand it, and we'll realize we don't understand. So the news of the Torah isn't that we don't understand Parah Aduma. That's not the point here. The point is, stage one, seeing you don't understand, which leads to stage two, the nations of the world antagonize the Jewish people about it, leads to stage three, our pasuk, which nonetheless reinforces Zos Chukas HaTorah. It is a chok, and to in a sense, reassure us and to strengthen us with regards to this mitzvah. So that, I believe, although it's perhaps a simple point, it can be easily missed in this Rashi, what Rashi is explaining that the pasuk is actually coming to do. Now, there is a very interesting question concerning this whole Rashi. We say it's Rashi, it's quoting from Chazal in the Medrash about Chukim and our relationship with them, and more specifically, the other nation's relationship with them, which seemed to be something between ridicule or oppression, or maybe both. And that's how they relate to Chukim. But actually, there's a pasuk in the Torah elsewhere which seems to give us a very different message. In fact, perhaps even a contrary message. In the beginning of Parshas Vayeschanan, this is in Devarim, Perek Dalet, Pasuk Vav, Moshe says to Bnei Yisrael, Ushmartem va'asisem, keep the mitzvahs, do the mitzvahs. Kihi chochmaschem uvinaschem, for they are your wisdom and your understanding, le'enei ha'amim, in the eyes of the nations of the world. Here Moshe is talking to the Jewish people about how the nations of the world view them. Asher yishmu'un es kol ha'chukim ha'ele. They'll hear all of these chukim. Here we note the usage of the term chukim. They'll hear these chukim. Va'omru, and you know what they'll say? Wow. What a people. Rak am chacham v'navon. What a wise and discerning people. Hagoy hagadol hazeh. This great nation. So we have what appears to be somewhat differing reactions on the part of the nations of the world to the category of mitzvah that we call chukim. If you look in Rashi, and according to Rashi, the Torah itself is really preempting this, the only thing we can expect from the nations of the world about chukim is scorn and derision. But Moshe Rabbeinu didn't seem to say that. He says when they hear the chukim, they'll be just overwhelmed. They'll think that there's no end to your wisdom. So what is it? Are they impressed? Are they overwhelmed? Or are they underwhelmed, as they say? This question is raised by the Ran, Rabbi Nunissim, in his famous Drushus HaRan, in the end of the first Drush. And the Ran says, you know, what's very interesting about Chukim is that they do not answer to the laws of reason. Now, that yet could go in one of two directions. He gives a mashal. Sometimes you have people that they say things that don't really make much sense. The question is, what do we make of them? And there are two possibilities. They're either fools or they're geniuses, because both are equally incomprehensible. So how can you tell? You can tell by the results, as if to say, if someone comes and gives you a whole series of letters and it doesn't make any sense and it's a jumble, it could be that he just doesn't know anything. But it could be that this is a formula which can then serve to create a highly developed machine. So wait and see. In a sense, the proof of the talking is in the creating. Look at the results. Says the Ran, that is exactly what chukim are like. The only thing you can say about chukim is that they do not answer to what we call reason. There is no question that is true. But the question yet remains, the follow-up question is, well, are they higher than reason or lower? Because both are equally not reasonable. They're either irrational or super-rational. They're just not rational. How can you tell? Says the Ran, it really depends on the state of the Jewish people themselves. And this is a fascinating part of the equation. Says Ran, if you look at the next pasuk, in Vayeschanan, Moshe has just said, when the nations of the world hear about chukim, they'll be blown away. Pasuk Zion, the next pasuk, Ki mi goy gadol, for what other nation, great nation is there? Asher lo Elokim krovim elav, who has Hashem close to you, kashem Elokeinu b'chol kareinu elav, as Hashem is close to us when we call him, whenever we call him. As if to say, the response, the positive impression of the nations of the world when it comes to chukim is not just in hearing the chukim. It's in hearing chukim, which don't make sense, and looking at the Jewish people, who also don't make sense. Their history doesn't make sense. And they seem to be very successful, if they are, unusually successful. And that's the point where the nations of the world say, well, we can't really work out how the Jewish people are doing as well as they are. What's the difference between us and them? We have laws and they have laws. We both have mishpatim, and they can't necessarily see the difference between our mishpatim and theirs. The difference comes out in the chukim, as if to say, whatever they have going for them, it's got to be in these mysterious laws. But look at the results. They're on top of the world. But that's only true when they are on top of the world. And that's why, in the context that Moshe is talking, if Hashem it responds whenever we call him, it must be that we have something that no one else has. That's called chukim, and the nations of the world will be duly impressed. However, when the Jewish people are not on top of the world, what if they're on the bottom of the world? and they're still keeping these chukim, that's when Rashi comes in. Chukas HaTorah is through thick and thin. It's to see the Jewish people through difficult times when they're not necessarily doing so well. They're hanging on, but they're not doing spectacularly well. Under those circumstances, the chukim, they are perceived as failing. And then the chukim will now be seen as things that are perhaps holding them back because they don't seem to make any sense. So it's very interesting that the very same thing could go either way. Look at the results. And he draws an interesting example of this, an illustration from the well-known story of Naaman. Naaman, who was that Assyrian general, and he had his form of tzaras. And he comes to Elisha, and he was not expecting what Elisha said. Because Elisha said, go to the Yarden, dip in it 7 times, and you'll be fine. And see me in the morning. And Naaman originally responded with derision. He says, the Yarden, I'm missing where I am. I've got rivers that dwarf the Yarden. How's it going to work? Because he didn't think it would work, and because it didn't make any sense, he thought it was ridiculous. Until someone says, you know, you've come this far, may as well try it. The worst that can happen is you'll get wet. So he dips in the Yarden 7 times and he's cured. Everything changed at that point. It didn't make more sense to him. It remained beyond his reasonable capacity. But one thing had changed. He saw that it worked. And once he said that, in Naaman's own words, now I know the God of the Jewish people is like no other. Everything was flipped around by the results, even though the very thing remained as unreasonable working as it did when he thought that it wouldn't work. So that's a very interesting comment to bear in mind from Rabbeinu Nissim in Drush Aleph there. Now, I'd like to spend really the main part of the shiur on the episode that one form or another always seems to dominate the Parshas Chukas, and that's Mei Meriva, the episode with the rock. And the only thing we can say with certainty about this episode is that it's very difficult to understand exactly what went wrong. But one thing is for sure, and that is that the key to some form of understanding will only come from paying careful attention to the psukim at hand. And therefore, in this instance, we place ourselves in the reliable hands of the Malbim. Malbim, of course, is famous for his attention to detail. As we will see, the concept of Malbim and casual reading don't go together. It's an exacting process. And it's quite a mahalach. I say there's sometimes where before you start a certain understanding of a parsha, you've got to say not only Birchas HaTorah, sometimes Tefillas HaDerech as well. But let us see how the Malbim will guide us. And we'll preface with a number of questions, and some of them I think are well known. They are the questions that everyone asks. And then the Malbim has his own particular questions, and we'll see Mitzvah Shem as he puts it all together. Firstly, we ask, what exactly was the chet? What was it that Moshe did wrong, so to speak? Now, the common understanding, the common notion is he was told to talk to the rock, but actually he hit the rock, and that was not okay. But this itself breeds two questions, or begets two questions. Firstly, again, we have to ask, what difference does it make? What difference does it make if he hits the rock or if he speaks to the rock? I mean, they're both miracles. One's a miracle by hitting, one's a miracle by speaking. But at the end of the day, the result is the same. Why does it make such a difference? That is the question. And secondly, and if we follow with the psukim here, which is in, we should have the psukim in front of us in Perek Kaf. And here is Pasuk Zayin, Perek Kaf, Pasuk Zayin. Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe l'emor. The people have complained. We're starting in the middle. The people have complained. There's no water. Hashem says, Kach es hamate. Take the staff. Va'akele sa'eda. Atah ba'aron echicha. Gather everyone together. And he does say, speak to the rock. V'dibartem el ha'sele. He does. But it's still worthwhile asking. If the last thing that Moshe wants to do is hit the rock, why is it that the first thing he's told to do is to take his staff? That doesn't sound to be moving in a straight line. Someone should have removed the staff from the premises, not be told to take it. It's all the more interesting when we, and for the sake of completion, if we compare this rock episode with an earlier one, which doesn't get as much press because everything went okay within context, but that's at the end of Parshas Beshalach in Perek Yudzayin, where they come to a place, originally it's called Rephidim, it will be renamed, as we'll see, and the people are thirsty. And Hashem says to Moshe, this is in Perek Yudzayin, Pasuk Hei, Avor lefnei ha'am, go before the people, Vekach itcha mizikne Yisrael, take the elders with you, Umatcha asher kisa boas hayor, kach biyodcha v'halachta, and take the staff with which you smit the Nile, smote the Nile, take it with you, V'hi kisa batzur, hit the rock, V'yotzu mimenu mayim v'shasam, and water will come out, the people will drink. So this is now much more intriguing, because what was considered to be the wrong thing to do in Parshas Chukas was actually the right thing to do in Parshas Beshalach. He was told to hit the rock. Apparently, it's mutter. It's okay. And therefore, the question now will be, why was what was the recommended course the first time round, the course to be avoided at all costs the second time round? What's changed? The rock is the same, the water is the same, the staff is the same. Why did circumstances change? Or what is it? Now again, if we look closer at Pasuk Ches, and there's a few angles here. Kach es ha-mata, Hashem says, take the mata. V'hakele so'eida atov aron achicha, gather the congregation. V'dibartem el ha-sele le'enehem, v'nasan me'mav. Speak to the rock, right, in their presence, and it will give forth its water. You take out water from the rock, and give drink to the congregation, to their animals. Here too, one or two questions. Firstly, the exiting of water from the rock is mentioned twice. Firstly, it says, "V'nasan me'mav," it will give forth its water, which sounds like the water has gone forth from the rock. But the very next phrase says, Votse solehem mayim minasela, take out water. What is the meaning of Moshe taking out water when the rock has already given its water? That's a fair question. Are these the same thing? Why is it doubled over? With further attention to detail, the water is not referred to in the same way, not exactly, in these two phrases. The first phrase says V'nasan Meimav. The Yud and Vav at the end, that suffix, means its water. Okay, why is it called its water? Don't know, I guess it's from the rock. But the next phrase says V'hotse Solehem Mayim Minasela. What is the difference between Meimav, its water, in the first phrase, and Mayim, water, in the second phrase? And finally, for this Pasuk, the first phrase is addressed from the, or is phrased from the rock's point of view, so to speak. V'nasan me'imav. The rock is the subject. It will give. In the second phrase, Moshe is the subject. V'hotsei solehem. You will take out water. The rock is the object. Mayim min hasela. Okay. What's the difference between the rock giving its water and Moshe taking it out? Now, a final point of comparison. In the beginning of Pasuk Ches, Moshe is told, Kach es hamate, v'hakeles ha'eda, take the staff, and gather the Eda. Eda meaning congregation. Okay. Moving forward to Psukim, to when it actually happened, Vayakhilu, Pasuk Yud, Vayakhilu Moshe v'Aaron, Moshe and Aaron gather together, es ha'kahal, the congregation, el p'nei ha'sola, facing the rock. Something's changed. They were told to gather the Eda. In the event, they gathered the Kahal. Now for us, those two terms, I think, are largely interchangeable. you could use the same words to translate both of them. Ado is congregation, kahal is congregation, but the pasuk has changed, which means seemingly that something has changed. But what has changed as we move from Ada to kahal? What is the difference in connotation between those two words? Further, Moshe addresses the people in Pasuk Yud. Vayakilu Moshe ba'aron es ha-kahal al-pnei ha-sala. He gathers everyone by the rock. Vayom alehem and says, Shimonu ha-morim. He addresses them, he calls them rebels. That's the classic translation. Actually, the word morim literally means teachers, which doesn't sound that bad. Morim is a good thing. Mamrim are rebels. Morim are teachers. But what does Moshe mean by this? There's a famous statement or a comment of the Medrash. Morim is Morim es Morehem. They like to teach their teachers. There are some people who are like that. They like to teach their teachers. Okay? By the time they're finished, sometimes they're surprised at just how much their teachers have learned. But the Morim es Morehem, you can see that Chazal are responding to the literal translation of Morim. But what type of insult is that? Some teachers take it as a compliment. And then Moshe says, Haminasela hazen utzilachemayim, shall we take out water from the rock? What is the meaning of that question? Is it a rhetorical question? If it's a linear question, I think the answer is yes, because everyone's thirsty. So what does Moshe mean by saying, shall we take out water from the rock? And the next thing we know, things start to go wrong. Another difference in terminology. Again, comparing the earlier episode with this one. Here, the rock is called Sela. V'dibartem el ha-sela. But if we go back to Parshas Bishalach, the pasuk that we quoted from Perek Yud Zayin and Shmos refers to a tzur. Now, what is a tzur? A rock. Again, the difference in connotation will be lost in translation instantly, because tzur is a rock and sela is a rock, but seemingly they're not the same. But what is the difference between them? And why does the difference between them make a difference for us? Finally, the word meriva is used in both as a result of what happened. Both places had a name coined for them associated with meriva. In Bishalach, in the earlier episode, the entire place is called meriva. Rephidim was renamed as meriva. Okay. In our case, the place was not renamed. The place was Kadesh, by the way. Fine, we'll get there in a moment. The title that was attached was Mei Meriva. Interestingly, the waters of contention, the waters renamed. But the place didn't chap the name, the water chap the name. What's the difference between calling a place after the Meriva or calling the water after the Meriva? This brings us to the end of our question stage of Mei Meriva. And as we can appreciate, these are things that perhaps we may not have noticed, but from here the understanding is built. The first thing, says Malbim, we need to know is that this place where they are, Kadesh, is not like other places that they arrived at. If we look at Pasuk Aleph of Perek Kaf, we already see a difference. Pasuk Aleph reads, Vayavo'u b'nei Yisrael, kol ha'eda midbar tzin, the entire congregation came to midbar tzin, b'chodesh ha'rishon, vayeshev ha'am b'kadesh. They settled in Kadesh. This is the first place since we left Mitzrayim that the word vayeshev has been used, because vayeshev means settled. It's not the normal term as we go from place to place. The norm is vayisu vayachanu. Vayisu from here, vayachanu there. But here it doesn't say vayachanu bekodesh. Interestingly, it says vayeshev on bekodesh. They settled. Why? Because, says Malbim, finally they've reached a place which is actually civilization. People live in Kadesh. It's very interesting to consider what the population of Kadesh made of the Jewish people arriving. But people live here somehow. No one lives in the desert. I mean, not permanently. So those are stations. Vayisu, vayachanu, from here to there. But Kadesh is already the edge of entering civilization. And therefore, it's a place of Yishuv, and that's why it says Vayeshev Am BeKadesh. Now, the Jewish people, the way that they're complaining, clearly are actually missing two things. They're in need of two things. Number one, water, because they don't have water. And number two, they need a bit of a boost in their emunah, because at the first sign of no water, they fall to pieces. So this episode should be used to boost their emunah as well. And that's win-win. Those are the two benefits. Water, but also a lesson in emunah. No reason why they shouldn't get both. And this brings us to the difference between Tzur and Sela. Tzur and Sela are both rocks. But the difference is that Tzur is a rock. It is dry as flint. That means it's in a place where there is no water. That's the Tzur itself actually can also mean flint. As if to say, there's no water to be found in the region. Here in Kadesh, there is water. A Sela is more a rock that exists in a place where there could be water. And that means that in principle, it should be possible somehow through manipulating the rocks or uncovering something or moving something to essentially expose a water source which naturally exists there. That you may need to increase it exponentially to take care of the Jewish people. That may well be. But the base in principle exists already because it's a Sela. But if that happens, then they'll get their water, but they'll miss the miracle. They'll miss the opportunity to boost their emunah. And therefore, Hashem does not want for them to have that water that's naturally to be found there. Something else will happen. Namely, the first thing is for Moshe to draw out the natural water that's there. And that's not for the people. Once that's happened, and all you're left with is now basically a rock with no water around it, that rock will then become a source of water. That's stage two. So in other words, you have two stages here in Pasuk Ches. If we go back to see these two phrases. The first thing is V'dibartem el ha'sela le'enehem, speak to the rock, V'nasan me'mav, and it will give its water. Why is water in stage one called its water? Because it's the water that naturally exists there. It's the water that's naturally found there in that location. So that will first come out. And then some stage two, votes a solahem mayim min hasela. You take out water, not its water. It doesn't have any water anymore. That's when Moshe comes in. The water that the Jewish people will get to drink is the water that shouldn't exist there at all, which Moshe then draws out from the rock itself. And that's what the Jewish people will be drinking. So now the question is, how should this come about? As soon as we begin to appreciate that these two phrases are two stages, what is it that will bring about these two stages? And the guiding principle here, says Malbim, is that every miracle needs a trigger. Every miracle needs a something. We find that the Eser Makos were preceded by a miracle, an act, and so it is with it's the interface, in a sense, to harness that miracle energy, so to speak. However, as much as it needs an action, but the action can't be one that could be misconstrued as a natural act, because then again, you miss the miracle. Therefore, so it's got to be something, but it can't be something that would perhaps be just taken as, oh, well, if you did that, then naturally it would have that effect. It has to be understood that even after that act, the effect was supernatural and miraculous. And therefore, says Malbim, if you look at these two types of water, again, accessing or tapping into the natural water that's there, and that stage two, somehow generating water that isn't there, the difference between them is that the first one, because it's naturally there, you don't want an action involved there. Because if you hit something, so then that could be misconstrued. Well, there was water there, he hit it, he dislodged it, he moved something, and then the water naturally came out. And that's why for stage one, it can't even be an act. Stage one of accessing the water that's there can be only speech. It's something, but no one could misunderstand that the words brought the water out. That's stage one. Stage two, once that water, Meimav, the natural water, has run its course and you're left with a dry rock, you can hit it. Because there's no room for misunderstanding. There is no water there if it comes out of the rock itself. And therefore, there's no reason why Moshe should not be able to hit the rock for that second type of water. And in fact, that brings us back again to the first episode in Parshas Bishalach. The first episode in Parshas Bishalach, Moshe just had to hit the rock straight. He doesn't need to talk to it. Why not? Because it's a tzur. The first episode was in the middle of the desert. There's no water there, which means you go straight for what we are calling stage two. It's just about taking water where there's no water. And therefore, it's not a sela. It's a tzur. It's not a rock exists with water. There's no water. And therefore, Moshe's told to hit the rock and it's completely fine. It's only here that firstly he needs to speak to the rock to get rid of that water, and then of the natural water, and then when it's just the rock, then you can hit the rock. That's the plan. Now, the question is, what happened? Because something did not go according to plan. Moshe did not follow this program or this course to the letter, and the question is why. Clearly, Moshe perceived that there was something that would not allow him to follow this the way that he's been told to. But what is that thing? Here, says Malbim, we come to the difference between the term Eda and Kahal. We translate them both as congregation, and we miss the difference between them. What is the difference between them? Says Malbim, there's two types of congregations. There's congregations when they're organized and focused and acting as they should, and there's congregations where it's just a rabble. Eda comes from the word moed. Moed is something that is appointed, something that is organized. When the Jewish people are as they should be, they're called an Eda. But if perhaps they do not come together in the way that they should, but they're just an assembly of people almost, that's when they're called a Kahal. This is not to be used disparagingly for any Kehillas or any Kahals anywhere, or clearly that's meant in a complimentary way, but in Lashon HaKodesh, Eda is the way it should be, properly orientated and aligned. Kahal could do better. And how does that affect us here? Says Malbim, and again, we're constantly going back to the Psukim here. In Parshas Bishalach, when Moshe is told to hit the rock, he's told to take Zikanim with him. Isn't that right? In Shmos Perek Yud Zayin. V'kachitcha mizikney ha'am. They should also go with you and hit the rock. Why is it important that the elders of the Jewish people should be there? Apparently, because the Jewish people also need to be worthy of such a miracle. And therefore, the elders who are the cream of the Jewish people, they also need to be part of the process. That's very interesting. It is possible that it's a group effort, so to speak, as if to say, the representatives of the Jewish people closest to the rock should be the elders of the Jewish people. They're also part of it. And that's why Moshe was told to take the elders with him. And between all of you, you, of course, at the helm, but them right behind you, water will come out. Now, when Moshe is told to gather the Eda in our parsha, Eda means correctly organized, which means Zakenim first, which makes it just like the original episode. You should be there, and who should be right behind you? The Zakenim. In the event, the Jewish people didn't get themselves together as an Eda. They were too unruly. They were too disorganized. And therefore, as the Pasuk says, that Moshe and Aaron, when they gathered people together, the people came together as a Kahal, but not an Eda. This begins to get Moshe wondering and doubting as to whether, notwithstanding the instructions he was given, whether conditions are conducive to that plan working. Because there's no Eder here. There's only a Kahal. Where is the Kanim? They've been pushed aside. They're back. They're in the back somewhere. Everyone else is pushing and shoving. Which means, says Moshe, or thinks Moshe, perhaps we do not have the sufficient arrangement and alignment for the miracle to come out in the way that it should. That is Moshe's doubt. And that is why Moshe here addresses the Jewish people as Morim, as teachers. And this is why it is such a castigating comment. It's such a critical comment. People who teach their teachers. In other words, he's saying, where are your teachers? Where are the Zakenim? They've practically been trampled underfoot. They're there in the corner somewhere. They should be first. But they're not. And that's why Moshe says, and voices a real concern, Hamin ha-sela ha-zeh natzilachem mayim. Shall we bring out water? Can we bring out water? And he uses the plural because Moshe understands that it's the Jewish people together who will bring out the water. But it's the Canaan first. But they're not first. They're lost, or in the middle, or at the side. And therefore he is asking this question, do we have the capacity to bring out water? And he is not sure that they do. And he doesn't want to talk to the rock or to go for the higher level miracle, because if it backfires and nothing works, it's even worse. And therefore, says Malbim, Moshe takes the safer option. He takes the safer option of, number one, not talking to the rock. He takes the more active approach of hitting the rock. And moreover, he hits the rock, Vayetsu Mayim Rabim. It doesn't have the two stages. Those two stages, they fall away. It's just one thing now. There's natural water there. Moshe chooses the safer course of capitalizing on the natural water, albeit expanding it, as opposed to draining it off and then creating new water. And that's why in the event, Pasuk Yud Aleph says, Vayare Moshe Shado, he raises his hand, Vayachas Asela B'Mateo Pamami, he hits the rock twice, Vayetsu Mayim Rabim, a lot of water came out. But he didn't take it out in that way. It's that the water was there, and a lot of water came out. Mayim Rabim, sufficient for the people. So they didn't go thirsty. But the miracle was sorely compromised. And again, all of this as a result of Moshe's doubt, as the Jewish people, as they presented themselves, perhaps they weren't worthy of this miracle in that arrangement. Well, we have to ask, although it's a difficult question, in conclusion, just the final wrap up, the final two or three points, what was Moshe's wrongdoing? As if to say, he had a legitimate doubt. He had a significant grounds for concern that conditions would not allow for the miracle as he was told to perform it to actually happen. We must conclude, and this now becomes a problem on the level of Moshe Rabbeinu, we must conclude that doubts notwithstanding, he should have pushed ahead, and even though it didn't seem like the miracle would happen, nonetheless, there was opportunity for Kiddush Hashem and to move forward, and Hashem would have provided. Hashem would have come through regardless of where the Zakenim were. That is seemingly the problem. But that's a very subtle issue. That if you're Moshe Rabbeinu, those things become issues. But now just to come back to the naming of the place. The earlier place was renamed Meribah, originally called Rephidim, now Meribah. The later place, the place doesn't get renamed, but the water is called May Meribah. Why? Says Malbim, because in the earlier occasion, the place was the problem. When they got to the place, they were contentious. But when the water came out, and as it should come out, nothing went wrong, so the contention was quelled. And therefore the contention is attached to the place, but not to the water. In our case, however, since the miracle came out, or the water came out through a miracle that left much to be desired, the Meribah continued even as the water came out. And that's why the Meribah, the contentiousness, is associated with the water itself. It didn't end with the water. It flowed into the water because they were saying, and why did it come out like this? And how come he hit the rock? And etc. and so forth. It didn't end the story. And therefore the story is within the water itself. And perhaps, just as a final comment, later on, This episode is revisited or retrospected a couple of times in Parshas Pinchas and in the end of Devarim. And at the end of Devarim there, Hashem says an interesting, so to speak, expression. Hashem says, Hashem ma'altem bi, with an ayin, Hashem ma'altem bi, talking about this episode. What does ma'altem bi mean? What is me'ila? Me'ila, actually, the common translation is you disobeyed, you betrayed, me'ila. But me'ila actually is to take something holy and to use it for a non-holy purpose. And perhaps one could say that that's what's happening here, because Moshe used a miracle, but it didn't have a miraculous purpose, because people were just insisted on seeing it as a natural thing. They took that explaining away approach. He hid it, and there was water there anyway. Okay, a lot of water, a bit of water. What's a lot of water between friends? Well, it wasn't perceived as a miracle. To use a miracle and then not have it perceived as a miracle is me'ila. You're using a holy entity, but it doesn't have a holy outcome. It doesn't have a holy cause. It has a profane cause or mundane at the very most. And perhaps that is why the pasuk later on refers to it as me'ila. So this, very much in brief, but we can see how the Malbim sweeps through the parsha, and with all the attention to detail and the phrasing and the nuancing, from that comes out the picture, and that, as always, is good chinuch for us in terms of allowed to learn Torah. Are there other approaches to Me'ariva? Absolutely. Meretz Hashem, we'll leave something over for another time.